I am Randy Garris, and I am glad to be with you. I don't mind telling you the subject we're going to spend the weekend on, and we'll get to be, I hope, pretty good friends before the weekend's over. But the subject we're on is one that absolutely I would go anywhere. I'd do about anything to get a chance to talk to you about this. I care very much about what happens to your lives and your families. I don't mind telling you I know it sounds egotistical, and I don't mean it that way, but I don't intend for you to have a lukewarm weekend. My intention is to change your life. I owe it to your five-year-old girl you'll have one of these days. I owe it to the man or woman you're going to be married to. I owe it to you that this weekend is not just some kind of we filled in a little time, we went to a nice retreat. I care very, very much about families. I thought I cared a lot before. For some reason, God put me in an intersection with families. I have no idea. If I'd known God was going to put me in the counseling business for families, and if I'd worked with as many families as I've worked with in their marriages, I would have been like Jonah. I would have jumped on a ship and gone the other direction. I don't want to do this. But it has turned out to be one of the greatest privileges I've ever had in my life. But while I thought I cared before, the truth is, I'm now very much a grandfather. In fact, I may not want to admit it myself, but I'm in the last third of my life. That's kind of a scary concept. You look, well, that's not really true. We have a lady in our congregation that turned about 104 last week, so I'm just slightly middle-aged in light of her. But anyhow, she makes me a little more of that direction. But actually, by national statistics, I'm well into the last third of my life. I myself have two married children. I've got a daughter who's 22 who's still at home. She's our 7 years later after the other ones had grown up. I have five grandchildren. They're 4 years of age and under. And I look up, and in the blink of an eye, it's you and your families. And I watch how my own grandkids are being raised, and I don't mind telling you, I have high goals. For some of you in this room, I intend to break you up with who you're dating now. My intention is that this breaks you up this weekend, that you go and say, wait a second, I have unfinished business in my life, and I got to take care of that before I do damage in a relationship with somebody else. Others of you, I intend for you to say, you know, this is a valuable and wonderful person, and we may be together sometime, but they have unfinished business in their life. My intention is significant. Now, whether we can accomplish that, I have no idea, but we'll give it a shot. Why would I care about this? The reason I care is because a family is one of the most privileged, one of the greatest privileges God ever gives you. Of all the sweet things God ever made on the face of the earth, it's a home and a family. And when you die, and if you could summarize what the best thing about your life will be, I promise you it will not be that you shot par on some complicated, you know, golf course somewhere. It will not be because your artwork won third place in the county fair or something. The most privileged thing in your life will be that the people who loved you really loved you, and the people you loved, you really loved. And when you die, the greatest pain and the hardest things you will have will be stories about people you wanted to love in your family, and it just didn't work. And people who wanted to love you, and it just didn't work. I'm starting off sober. We'll have some fun. There's some fun things we tell. Maybe the best fun you'll have is when I'm done, but I don't know. But anyhow, we'll have some fun. It's over. They run with joy. But let me start off with a sober enough deal. And I may cause feedback on this silly thing, and I apologize if I do, but I need about 11 of you if you don't mind. I want you three if you don't mind. I need you three if you don't mind. I need you three if you don't mind. And using my quick math, I need you two. Would you come up front if you wouldn't mind? I'd like you to line up across here. I'd like you to step forward and confess the biggest sin you've done this week. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. Actually, I apologize that I can get close to some reality. I don't mean to in this, but I have to use statistics, and statistics are not numbers, they're people. And so while I'm going to impose some things on you, and what I impose on you, I'm really sorry in some cases because of how it will feel, because I may get too close to reality, but here's just the truth. Out of any number of 11 people of Christian kids who grew up and were part of churches and campus ministries, here's a reality. We'll have two of the Christian kids who decide that they give up on relationships and marriage. Literally, they will end up living with someone. They will live with someone. Their children will come with someone that they do not have a marriage with. And 90% of the time, 10 years later, they will not be with the individual they were living with. And their chances of a divorce and their next relationship will be about 65 to 70%. I don't know which 11 I'm talking to, but two of you fit that category. If I go down the street and I ask, now again, I got to go down a few years, but if I come and say, tell me about your life, four of you, these four out of that 11, when I knock on their house until I say, tell me about your marriage and your family, they will say, well, one of the hardest things that ever occurred was my divorce. And four out of the 11 will be divorced. I'm rounding numbers off. If I could have a half a person, I would take it, but I'm not sure how to do that, so I will leave it with just the four. And yet that's the only funny thing about that at all, because they will have children and lives that are torn apart. They will have scars they didn't choose and want. They'll have pictures that start off just like all of these pictures. Wedding gowns and bridesmaids and a great day. Now, you also need to know, I don't like this, but it's a simple reality. Right here will be 75% of the poverty of their community. Starting from that end to this end is 75% of the poverty. You need to know of children and teens who have suicides. 70 to 75% of them will come from their children. You need to know that those who will be alcoholics, 70% of them will come from this one down to this one. You need to know that when domestic abuse occurs and police have to come, 80% of it will come from this girl down to this girl. And they are you. This is not somewhere we're telling ghetto stories. We're just telling what is true. You're going through life as if it's just kind of a great ball right now, and you pay fees for your class and fees for parking and fees for activities and fees for this and fees for that, and you're just kind of having fun in college. But statistically, out of any 11, this will be this. Now, if I go to the others, take these two, and two of you, if you wouldn't mind coming. I'm going to make a separation here just so you can see the numbers a little different. These four will stay married to who they marry for the rest of their life. But here's the catch. Did I separate a couple here, did I? I'm afraid this is my story and I'm sticking with it. But here's the catch. These four will be married to whoever they marry for the rest of their life. But when you sit down and ask Heath, Sam, Becky, Lizzie, did you have the kind of marriage you want your children to have? They're going to tell me no. That we stayed married and it was better than being divorced and having all that pain. We were a notch up, but no, I don't want my children to have this kind of marriage. Statistically, and it changed in the last 15 years, I used to use old numbers. Truth is, I need the other one half person here, but I don't have them, so one and a half person. One individual out of the 11, one and a half out of the 11. If I ask this question and I say, Nathan, did you have the kind of marriage you want your children to have? Nathan will say yes. And everybody else is a no. 2, this group, we didn't even get married because we gave up on it, and we finally did get married, but it didn't work. Divorce, married, but we weren't happy. Now, do you care to roll the dice and figure what your odds are of becoming that one? My intent this weekend is to try to say to you as clearly as I can, it's not a roll of the dice. You're going to have to decide what you want for a relationship. And if you do what the neighbors do, you're going to get what the neighbors have got. If you do what the culture does, you're going to get what the culture gets. If you want a good marriage, and you want a home that you can raise your kids and look them in the face and say, sweetheart, I made choices so you grow up with a mom and a dad who loves you for the rest of your life. Mom and dad that weren't perfect, but you'll be safe with us relationally and emotionally. You're going to have to do something very, very radical. And I intend to try to help you this weekend become radical people in your relationships. Does that make sense? We're aiming to be that one. It's not a roll of the dice. You get to choose. Let's choose wisely. You can sit down. Thank you. So how's it work? What is the secret? How does this go? This is a bit complex. I know it is. And so I try to simplify it down best I can. But I think you'll grab a hold of it pretty easy. I have no doubt. The problem is not that we don't love. Everybody falls in love. In fact, fall in love is the easiest thing in the world to do. Any fool can do it, and most fools do several times. The issue of falling in love is not hard. If you say to yourself, well, I know those are statistics, and he's telling some numbers and all those sort of things, but I think I'm smart enough to know who to really love and when I'm really in love, and love will really, you know, what we have is it's special. I mean, we just love each other. Do you know that's terribly egotistical? I can tell you out of the 3,000 couples I've worked with, I can tell you they thought they were in love too. Just this last week, if I just go through last week's, Mandy, I bet she weighs 92 pounds now. And Mandy's about 5'7". Mandy has a 9-month-old baby. Her husband is a professing Christian, a strong professing Christian. He has been a youth sponsor in places, but they have their 9 or 10-month-old baby. And she has lost so much weight because he walked out on a marriage. He got his feelings hurt. They've been married about 7.5 to 8 years. And he just felt like she was neglecting him. And he got his feelings hurt. And this week, Mandy came up during the prayer time at church. And she just laid her head on my shoulder. And she just sobbed. She's the same age as my daughter. And she just sobbed. He went ahead when he walked out and then had an affair. And that was Mandy. When that prayer time was over, the next one that came up was Denise. And Denise came up and she said, Randy, I'm so sorry to bother you here at church. And Denise just started grabbing a hold of my shoulders. And she's going, Randy, I need help. I can't stand him anymore. I am so upset. I can't stand him. I can't take him anymore. I've become so hard. I'm mistreating him. I know it. And she's talking about her husband, Brandon. She moved out that week, and I didn't know it. They loved each other when they got married. They dated, and everybody said, man, they're perfect for each other. The issue is not whether or not you're in love. In love is easy. That's not a problem. The problem is nobody knows what in love is. You don't have any frame of reference. It's your first time through at the age you are and the relationships you've come from in your life. And so love just feels like love to you. The trouble is, it's a big generic word that means nothing. It means nothing. I tell the story all the time, and many people in this room have heard me do this stuff so many times they can almost quote it with me. But my grandfather was a wonderful old man, but my grandfather in his 80s got dementia. And you'd go by and see my grandpa, Arthur Garris, and you would say to him, "Grandpa, what'd you do today?" Now, this is a man with dementia. And he would say, "Well, I went to the tag and got the tag and got the tag and put the tag and I got the tag and put the tag on the tag and put the tag." And you felt sorry for the old guy. You thought, okay, he didn't have any reality. Well, it wasn't true. He actually did. What he was telling you was a story. He was telling you, "I went to the mailbox and got the mail and brought it in and I did this." And I mean, he was telling you a story, but he couldn't find the word he wanted to use. So he just used the word tag in its place. All you had to figure out is what he meant when he said tag, because it could mean anything. If you don't mind me borrowing that illustration, I would say this. Whenever somebody says, "I love you" in this culture, and they really do mean it, that's the truth. They really do, unless there's just something wicked about them. Truth is, they don't know what they mean by the word love, and you don't either. All they said is, "I tag you." Love basically breaks down in this culture this way. That how you understand love and how you understand giving it and receiving it breaks down into one of three areas, one of three ways. And depending on how you understand love, at your deep core, your most core level, it determines everything about what you're going to get. There are going to be, and I'm just going to give you, three ways that it's possible for you to understand love. Here's this way. It's 25 to 30% of all American marriages. It's a 1 to 3 year marriage. May last 50 years, but all the life sucked out of after about 1 to 3 years. It is the one that your age group is most susceptible for. If I go to your age group, it dramatically increases. It's not 25 to 30%. It's far more like 40 to 45% for your age group. But this group who feels in love, they honestly love each other. But it's a 1 to 3 year marriage. The second group is more popular within the whole culture. It's a 50%. 50 to 55% of all American marriages are this one. This 50 to 55% of all American marriages is one that looks better and smells better than that one. But it's a 5 to 8 year marriage. Many of you cannot figure out what happened in your parents' marriage. You grew up in a home that you either walked on eggs or you took sides or you just stayed out of it altogether and you couldn't figure out what was going on in your parents' marriage. There is a 50% chance or better, it's this one. It's a marriage that starts out fine, but it can't survive time. So 5 to 8 years. Typically, it's the one that when you begin to leave home and became a junior, senior, and you notice that your parents began to really have trouble then, it's this one. This one down here has moved to about 15%. 15 to 25%, you got to, whether you put in the couples living together or not. But about 15 to 25% of all American marriages are this one. And this one is the old couple that loves each other and grows old and tender, and they're holding hands when you see them walk. And they're the couple that when somebody says, "I want a marriage just like theirs," it's this one. Now, all three of these feel alike. All of them, they run a 107-degree fever. I mean, you go, "Wow, I'm deeply in love. I really like being in love." The emotion is very, very similar. But they are so radically different that depending on which one you have a very predictable future. Now, I will say this before I start. You may be in this one. When I finish, you go, "Wow, that's the relationship I'm in right now. Can it be changed?" Sure it can. It can become that one down there. You can change it. But it is not easy. It's kind of like a camel going through the eye of a needle. It's pretty hard. You'll have scars. There are scars worth having to change it. But it's hard to change, but you can change it. Can this one change? Absolutely. It can become the one you want it, but it's not easy. It's hard to change. And you better understand what you're changing. Tonight, in the time that we have, somewhere between now and 10 o'clock, I'm going to try to go through the first two of these. We have one word for love in the English language, and we use it for everything. I love hot dogs. I love, ice cream. I love my wife. I love Jesus. You know what I mean? I mean, you're going, what in the world is a word that you can use for hot dogs and Jesus? I mean, what is that? Okay? That's crazy. At least the Greek language, and that's what I'll use. In my background, I'm not a Greek scholar. I've got about 4 years of the Koine Greek of the New Testament, so I'll use it from that deal. But the Greek language had about a half a dozen different words you could use for love. Three in particular that were highly relational. I'm going to use the Greek words for them just because they were, it kind of split it up a little bit. 25 to 30% of all American marriages are an eros kind of love. You know the Greek word eros because you know it from the English word erotic. When you think sexual, it's certainly a portion of it, but you need to think much broader than that. The Greek word eros ultimately is translated in the concept that I'll love you if. It has the idea of our understanding why we love someone with an if in the middle of it. Well, why do you love someone? Well, of course I love them because if they did that for me, then I just couldn't help but love them back. If this is what they give, then the if I give back is I, of course I love them. It's an if concept of love. And it is a 1 to 3 year marriage. How would you know what that marriage is? Well, let me use some stereotypes. It's the cheap high school romance. You can see it all the way from the ugly ducklings back in eighth grade. He was kind of a little bit of a social outcast, and she was a little bit of a social outcast, and they didn't have each other, but she would love him if he gave her attention, and he would love her if she gave him attention, and so the sort of the ugly ducklings, several of us in the room might have, who am I kidding, some of us in the room are, that idea of I would give love if someone would love me. But it's not just the ugly duckling in high school. It's also the high school football stud who's wearing the letter jacket that weighs 77 pounds with all the junk on it. And it's the little bouncy cheerleader. And they're holding hands going down the hall. And everybody goes, ain't that sweet? I mean, that's just really true love. Yeah, it's a 1 to 3 year train wreck's what it is. Well, how can it be? She writes nice notes and puts them under his windshield, and he lets her wear, you know, his 36-pound ring, and it's on a, you know, chain around her neck. And I mean, that's just, they dance that dance, you know. You know why it's an if? It's pretty simple. This culture is really hard on girls. We're going to talk about it. In fact, the last two sessions, I promise you, we're going to get pretty close on who you are. I tend to come as deep as I can on who you are. But this culture is pretty hard on gals. You gals grow up in a pretty tough world where you don't feel pretty enough, skinny enough, talented enough, or well-liked enough. You girls grow up in a world that kind of devours you, and I'm really sorry for that. And the average girl has a hole in her chest. She grows up with this sense of, I know who I am as a little bitty girl, but I don't know who I am as a junior high girl. I don't know who I am as a sophomore in high school. I don't know who I am as even a college girl. I have a hole in my chest. And I'm not really happy. And so let's pick this girl in high school. I'm not really happy, but I would be happy if the right guy loved me. I'm one of just 700 girls around here. I'm just part of the crowd. I'm just part of the wallpaper kind of thing. My mama says she loves me, and my grandma says she loves me, and all that. But I'm just not content. But I'd be happy and content if the right guy loved me. And so there is an insecurity, and you know that. And there's so many other issues I could point out, but that'd be one. The average guy in this culture grows up incredibly self-centered. That's truth. I wished it weren't true, but it is. This culture causes girls to have a great insecurity, and they're not sure their identity, and they're trying to figure out their identity in light of how somebody else treats them. The average guy in this culture grows up self-centered, and I don't really blame the boy, and yet if he doesn't get over it, he'll always be a boy the rest of his life. I don't mean to be flippant with this, but the most worthless person on the face of the earth is a 13-year-old boy. Stay with me. Listen to me. Who needs him? That's truth. Who needs him? There was a culture and a place and a time where he moved from a little boy to a bit of a manhood where somebody needed him. But nobody needs him now to go chop the wood, so to speak, and bring it in. Nobody needs him to protect the animals from the wolves. Nobody needs him to really provide food for the winter. Nobody really needs a 13-year-old little boy except this. Would you just not create any problems for us? Would you just go off and please don't be a pain in the neck? Here's a video game. Go play to your heart's content. Here's a basketball. Go do something and make a name for yourself or something. And a 13-year-old boy begins the transition, which is the secret to life is to keep yourself entertained and to sort of let the world revolve around you. Now, that's a lie, and every now and then I tend to cuss. Only in sermons is when I cuss. I never cuss outside of sermons. That's the truth. My daughters, I have two daughters and a son, said, Dad, we've never heard you cuss outside of a sermon. And that's true. But I don't mind telling you, it's a damn lie that kids told. Because the word damn means destructive. It begins to tear this 13-year-old boy's life up because what? He just starts entertaining himself. Well, you can entertain yourself for a while with video games and fantasies that you'll be the next pro athlete or any number of things. You can begin to fantasize and entertain yourself in sexual kinds of ways. And so pornography has this explosion. Why? Because the secret to a little boy's life is at some point in time, nobody needs you. Entertain yourself. So the football stud who walks down the hallways bumps into, and he's self-centered, bumps into the cheerleader who has a hole in her chest. What do you think happens? They're in love. They're deeply in love. And he basically says, and I'm being a touch crass on this, I don't mean it quite as much, but the idea is that if you will be sexually easy, or if you at least are a wonderful decoration for my arm that make me, if you entertain me more, maybe she's not even sexually active with him, but if you will be, I will give you my love in return. And if you'll make me be somebody who matters around here, I'll give you my love. And it's an if. It's a contract. It's the number one reason seniors get married in college. It's the number one reason seniors get married in college. I've grown up next to a state college. I say grown up. I've been 28 years in the ministry where I'm at right now, College Heights Christian Church. We're right next to Missouri Southern State University. I can tell you beyond the shadow of a doubt, it is the number one reason the upperclassmen and the graduates start getting married. You see, she herself loved the idea of being a career woman and starting her career, but she's worked enough summers, and she's been the bridesmaid at 37 straight weddings. She's holding the baby of all of her friends. Sweet mates have moved in and out. She was really good friends with who she roomed with first, but bit by bit, the world changes. They go different places. They're getting their master's, and she's still staying around getting hers or whatever the case may be. And pretty soon, that hole in her chest can't be filled with other stuff very much. And she gets to thinking, I'm not very happy, but I would be happy if the right guy loved me. Meanwhile, he's joked about being single and he hasn't bit the dust and how he's still, you know, always buddies are getting married or they're going into these relationships, but he's still out there. Truth is, though, he's kind of tired of this whole dude. He's tired of fixing his own meals. Tired of doing his own laundry once every 3 months. Tired of cleaning his own apartment once every 6. Actually, truth is, this guy begins to have the world kind of change around him, and he begins to realize bit by bit, my world's changing too. And he too has a hole in his chest. And you come to your senior year, which may be your 6th or 7th or 8th year at college, and you say to yourself, you know, there's lots of great kids that I know, and if I don't sort of get serious in a relationship now, I'll be out there, I'll be working in Wyoming with a divorcee and 2 kids as the only one in the office. And I mean, ultimately, I kind of need to get to picking while the picking's good. Now, nobody thinks that objectively. That's not thought at the front of your brain. It's thought at the back of your brain. You ever catch yourself at the refrigerator and the door open and you're not even sure when you got up and when you walked there? On the way over here, I was driving. I looked down and thought, I've been camping in front of that stupid refrigerator, and I have no idea when that happened. went from 193 to, I think, I'm bumping 219. I'm going, when did that happen? That's a royal pain. Truth is, it's subjective. But that couple will start dating a little bit in October, and they'll start dating hot and heavy, and Christmas and Valentine's will come, and it's really a key time, and something special is happening, and they'll get married in the summer because they really love each other. No, they don't. No, they don't. No, they don't. What they do is really need each other. Well, that sounds romantic. We need each other. That's wonderful. Sweetheart, bless your heart. Here's what will happen in 1 to 3 years. In 1 to 3 years, you see, she didn't think she was pretty enough, skinny enough, talented enough, and well-liked enough, but she would be happy if the right guy loved her. And now they live in that apartment. And life's going on, but she looks in a mirror in the mornings. And he's in the bed in the other room. But she looks in that same mirror, but she still doesn't feel pretty enough, skinny enough, talented enough, or well-liked enough. What does she do now? She always used to believe I was married to the right guy. All this would got to go away. What does she do now that she's married and this guy? What's this guy do when he wakes up in the morning and suddenly realizes she doesn't love me? Oh, she loves some of the things about marriage. She loves some of the social status. She loves a little of the security of this. There's several things she likes about marriage, but she doesn't love me. And I can see it in her eyes every day that I'm letting her down. And what's this guy do who's self-centered, whose great thought was if I could just bed a woman every night, same gal, have her in my bed every night. Boy, that'd be just life. What do you do about after the 250th night you've been together? Or the 350th? When you suddenly realize you're two users. What happens is a girl who has a hole in her chest and a guy who has a hole in his. Different reasons, but they have a hole. And they sort of go, isn't that neat and wonderful? And they find that relationship. Truth is, it's a crutch relationship. And nobody can fix what's wrong with you. Nobody can fix that hole in your chest for you. And you got in a relationship and you married somebody hoping it would. And it just doesn't. It doesn't. The number one drug in America is not alcohol. The number one drug in America is another person. And we primarily get into relationships to fix what's wrong with us. We're nothing more than junkies just using a different kind of drug. How many junkies do you know who have ever been satisfied by their drug? It doesn't work. It doesn't work. This is a true story, and it's one that happened many years ago. Still gets me. We have a little Christian school in our building, about 600 kids in it. I went out in the foyer. There's a little girl, first or second grade, I kind of get mixed up now which grade she was. It's been 9 years ago now. I went out in the foyer, and this little girl sitting there after school crying, a little first or second grade girl. I sat down beside her on the couch and said, I knew her family pretty well. I sat down and said, sweetie, what's wrong? She starts crying harder, kind of lays her head against my shoulder. I just hugged her, patted her. I said, sweetie, what's wrong, hon? She finally stopped crying a little bit. She looked up at me and she said, Mr. Garris, she said, none of the boys in my class will go with me. I'm trying to keep a straight face. I mean, what do you say to a second grade or first grade girl whose big problem is none of the boys in class will go with her? And while I'm trying to keep a straight face, she finishes a sentence with this way. And Mr. Garris, in my class, if none of the boys will go with you, you're not anybody.
The number one drug in this culture is another person, and we use it to fix what's wrong with us. There's an amazing truth. The people who need to be in a relationship to be okay will never be in an okay relationship. That's a reality you need to grab a hold of. If you need to be in a relationship to be okay, you will never, ever, ever be in an okay relationship. The only people who can have great relationships are people who have figured out what to do with the hole in their chest prior to or very quickly in a relationship. The people who have great marriages are people who can stand on their own two feet, whole and healthy and well, and we'll talk about what that means in a second, but they choose to have a great marriage because they can invest in each other. We'll talk about this a whole bunch more tomorrow night, I think. But people who lean, they never do it. Well, what's it mean to stand on your own two feet? Well, there are three things in particular I'd take out of the book of Proverbs, and again, we'll talk about this more tomorrow night as well and also on Sunday morning. But the people who can stand on their own two feet, happy, personal happiness, personal contentment, and their own personal morality and character, people who can stand that way, those people can get together and have wonderful relationships. But if you'll notice, those three things, happy, content, and moral, the idea of just having joy and peace, maybe better words, if you have personal joy, regardless of circumstances, you don't borrow circumstances to have joy. You have personal peace in your own skin. You have contentment. I like who I am. I know how God made me. I know what God thinks of me. I'm content in who I am. And I have my own personal morality. I'm not blowing in the wind. I understand. I'm made in the image of God. And I know somebody who has those three basic characteristics will do well in life. But the absence of that, you end up having to use some kind of crutch. Everybody came in life without those three. You came in life without any of those three. You came in horizontal, so to speak. Your mama carried you up and down hallways and you were colicky and crying. And the reason she carried you because you didn't have your own personal happiness or contentment. And bit by bit, you began to borrow from your parents. You began to stand up just a little bit, but you borrow from your parents. And so that's why parents watch their kids so closely, because you need to be given these things. We give them to you. You don't have your own. And so parents do it. But you got into first, second grade, and you begin to borrow from friends. So you borrow from parents early, then you start borrowing from friends. Why do first, second, third grade girls need other girls so much? The answer is not just that they're social, but they're borrowing. They're borrowing happiness and contentment. It's the reason girls run in a bit of an amoeba group, going to the bathroom or the playground or anything else is why. It's relational. Girls are relational. But at a core of that has to do with the idea of borrowing happiness and contentment. Little boys, it's a funny thing about little boys. They will borrow from one another. They borrow morality. That's the truth. That's why you can have a little boy who's a terrific little boy. I mean, wonderful little boy. Great family, but you let him run. I mean, he's in fourth grade or fifth grade. You let him run with those little hoodlums down the street, and he's shooting out street lights with his BB gun. You're going, "You hypocrite, you! What's wrong with you?" He's not a hypocrite. He's just a fourth or fifth, sixth grade boy who's borrowed his morality. He hadn't grown up yet. He's still borrowing. And here's what I wish we hadn't given you, and I am so sorry. My culture amplified and passed on to you. You see, you don't have your own personal happiness or contentment. You borrow from your parents first. You borrow from your friends next. But we put you in a Ken and Barbie world. And it started mattering that you found somebody, and somebody who gave you credibility as a person. And we began to borrow from boyfriends and girlfriends. And suddenly we became okay. This is wonderful. This is neat. No, it's not. It's sad. It's incredibly sad. If I had my choice, and I know I'm being facetious when I say this, but if I had my choice, I'd love to see you grow up with your group of friends. But I would love to pick you up, put you on a deserted island, which is you and God, and leave you alone for about 2 or 3 years. And when you're happy and content in your own skin, when you like who you are, when the hole in your chest begins to be repaired by understanding what it means to be a creature in the image of God, when you understand what it means to be blessed of God, when you understand that you yourself have a wholeness, bring you back, because you will be a jewel for any guy that you would invest in. But until that hole in your chest is taken care of, you're just another relationship user. Does that make sense? I realize it's a pretty heavy subject, and it'll get a little lighter as we go along in this. I do promise. But this one right here doesn't work. I'm very, very fortunate that my kids, my older two are married. But I'm very, very fortunate that my kids made some choices that I really do appreciate. My daughter Katie, I quote every now and then. Katie was still single about age 24, 25, I don't know. And I walked in where Katie was talking to a group of college girls. And I remember Katie saying to these girls, and she was quoting me. I know a lot of that because we grew up in the same house, obviously. But I don't mind telling you. I'm going, she gets it. Katie was talking to these girls, and she said, I would love to be married someday. And I would love to have a family. But she said, if I never get married and never have a family, I had to come to the place that I could be happy and content and that I could enjoy life and I could say to myself and to God, God, I'd love to have a family, but if I never have one, I'm actually okay. I'm going to say that to everybody here. If you cannot say that with integrity, you have unfinished business. Don't you be fouling up somebody else's life. If you couldn't say, I'm happy and content and I have joy, and it doesn't have to do with borrow from a relationship or the three-ring circus we live in. Until you can say that, you're nothing more than a bit of a risk walking around for somebody else to walk into a trap. Does that make sense? Everybody tracking with me a little bit? I used my wife for an illustration on that. Julie, I've been married 33 years. I'm married to a wonderful woman. We will use the phrase every now and then in a romantic sense of I need you. In fact, this last week, Julie and I were old couples hug, and I'm hugging her, and we're standing in the hallway. Something had happened in our family. It was a bit of a bruise and kind of hard, and I'm holding her, and she's kind of crying about something that took place in our family involving somebody we love a lot. And as I'm kind of patting her, she said, Randy, I need you. And I said, Julie, I need you. Now, please, hang with me a second. I know what she meant by that, but do you know the truth is that's not really the right word. If a meteorite fell and hit me on this trip and I never made it home, my wife would be perfectly fine. Because my wife has, before I met her and in our relationship, my wife has had joy and contentment and her own personal character, and it's come out of her own wholeness. And she's this woman who has chosen to love me. In fact, when we got married, I was more this, and she had to put up with quite a bit till I grew up some. If something happened to me, my wife would be perfectly fine. She could remain single the rest of her life if she chose to. Or my wife could choose to remarry, but she wouldn't have to remarry to be okay. I'm going to tell you
that the mother of my kids and the grandmother of my grandkids has got to be that kind of individual, or it's a three-ring circus. You're 18 to 20 plus in this room. Are you this or are you this? And we're going to talk more about it. But if you're this, you need to get out of a relationship. You have unfinished business. You may be a wonderful parasite, but you'll be a parasite. That's truth. Happy and content and moral is a prerequisite for a great relationship. We have 10 minutes to do the bigger one. Let me pull this over here and get away from the speaker quite as much. You're trying to get away from the speaker too, but yours is harder. I come from the high-tech world. Really, I do. I would say I'm an 8-track individual, but you don't even know what that is. I'm a cassette tape and an iPod world is what I am. But anyhow, actually, I have one of those email machines. And I have an iPod I listen to, if you know. I have my daughter load it for me regularly. This is the first one. Here's the second one. The second one sounds better. If some boy said to you, I'll love you if, and it had sexual connotations, or there's any if, you would resist it. The second one sounds much better. The second one is, I love you because. It's the Greek word philos. You know it from the English word Philadelphia, city of brotherly love. Philos, P-H-I-L-O-S. Philos is a word that if you translate it into English, it translates, I love you because. Well, Hallmark's made $1 million, gazillion billion dollars off that, I love you because. I mean, Valentine's Day just went by and all the cards are, I love you because. You know, that sounds wonderful in a romantic way. It's kind of like my wife saying, I need you, or that sort of thing. Truth is, if your love is based upon the concept of I love you because, you're in trouble. It's a 5-to-8-year marriage. You see, the first form of love basically says, if you meet my needs well enough. Well, nobody can meet your needs well enough. If you do enough stuff to make my love be attracted to you, I will love you. Well, nobody can do that. You're going to end up being frustrated. People are going to let you down. You're going to be aggravated. You're going to feel like you're always getting cheated. This is this one. The I love you because basically does this. It draws a box. Now, you don't know this consciously, I know that, but you draw a box in your mind, and then you put the traits that you really admire and appreciate in somebody's life, and you sort of look around till you find someone who has that box. You could use any number of traits. I want somebody who's hardworking. I want somebody who's funny. I want somebody who's gentle. I want somebody who has lots of money. I don't know what you want. I mean, you know, you've got your things. And you have a box of what you're looking for. And what happens is you start dating. You say, man, no, not my box. And no, not my box. And no, not my box. And then you go, that's my box. Yeah. And what happens? We basically, another word we use is chemistry. Oh, the chemistry was right. When people say chemistry, you almost always know what they mean by that is there's something I've been looking for subconsciously, and they seem to have the things that I kind of, wow, lights my fire. I love them because of what they are. And the reason you didn't love the other person was they didn't have the traits. I mean, they were outside the box, and so they didn't fit. That's not somebody you'd be interested in. Well, this sounds wonderful, but here's the problem. You didn't marry a rock. You pick up a rock, it's going to be pretty much the same rock 10 years from now. Yep, it hadn't grown, it hadn't changed, it's pretty much the same rock. You marry a human being, and you fall in love with them because of what they are. Good luck, kid.
You change in personality in definable ways at least every 6 months. If I take even one trait, take the one trait here of lighthearted, witty, and fun to be around, what happens is over a series of 6 months, that trait changes every 6 months. It changes left and right. It may come back a little bit, but I guarantee you that a 19-year-old kid, lighthearted, witty, and fun to be around, is not the same guy who's 32. The one who's lighthearted, witty, and fun to be around, who has in this box that you love them because of what they are, give them 5 to 8 years of changes. It happens all the time. In fact, it happened, and I use this illustration a lot, but it just played itself out 10 days ago. I get a knock on the door. It's an individual comes in and says, "Randy, can we talk?" And then they start just spilling their heart and going, "Randy, I just don't love him anymore. I wished I did. He's a great guy or she's a great gal, but I just don't love her anymore. Something's happened. The love died. The chemistry used to be there, but the chemistry's not there." And then later on, you'll hear them start getting angry. Why are they angry? Because he changed. You see, when I married him, he was like this. But now then, all these years later, we have 3 kids and he's 32 and I got a guy down here. He's not like that at all. He changed. Well, why did he change? If you take just even one trait, lighthearted, witty, and fun to be around, he changed here because ultimately he went to work and they gave him 18 or 19 employees to supervise. Right here, his son was born, and I don't know why the birth of his son changed Mr. Lighthearted, Witty, and Fun to be Around, but it changed him. Right down here, his brother was killed in a motorcycle wreck. What happened to Mr. Lighthearted, Witty, and Fun to be Around? Right down here, he lost one of his parents. Tell me, what? Right down here, they found a little knot on his neck, and they say it's benign, but you got to watch it. And suddenly, his own mortality begins to kind of stand in front of him. And she's got a guy down here now who's like this, because every one of those traits have changed some. Logically, you understand this. If you fall in love with someone because of what they are, what do you do when they change and they're no longer the same? I joke about it, but falling in love this way is the same as it's almost like picking out pups. You come to my garage and say, "I'm going to pick out a pup." I don't have any pups, thankfully, but it's my metaphor. You pick up this pup and say, "No, I don't like it because its ears fall over funny. No, I don't like it because it's not the right color. No, I don't like it because it's the wrong size. No, I don't like it. I just don't like it." And you pick it up and you go, "Ooh, this is the right pup. It's just perfect." And you take it home. How long do you have it at home before its ears fall over funny like the ones you didn't want? How long do you have it home before its coloring changes like the one you didn't want? How long before its size changes where it's no longer cute and cuddly like the one you did want? How long before, and the answer is, just in our little town, used to say 6,000 abandoned animals, there's 8,000 abandoned animals in our little town. You know, the primary reason is because I loved it when it was this, but it changed and became something different, and we couldn't stand a big dog in the backyard kind of thing or in the house, and we didn't know what to do with it, and so we just had to get rid of it. I've done that in my marriage counseling till the world looks level. I am sick of it. I am sick of it. And you go to his desk and you say, "Why? Why are you leaving Karen? And why are you leaving Karen and the 2 boys? Why are you filing for divorce? What are you doing?" And he will say, "Karen's a wonderful person and I wish her well. But Randy, I outgrew her. I changed and she didn't change. Or Randy, she changed. I'm still the same guy, but she changed." You see, if I actually do this right, truth is, this system has 2 people who are drawing boxes. And when they got married, it was like that. But what happened in 5 to 8 years? What's the chances they changed parallel? The answer is almost none. And they didn't know what to do with their changes. It was painful. And you love someone because of what they are. What do you do when they're no longer what they were? So he gets really involved in his work and she gets really involved with the kids. And then she decides she needs to go back to school or she wants more of a career, and so she goes there and he gets more involved in his hobbies and his golf and his racquetball or whatever it is. In fact, he may well get even more involved in church. One of my red flags that often occurs is when I watch a family where one suddenly begins to jump and get really involved in church. And she starts doing things more with her friends. And they want to love their partner, but what do? I guarantee you this. Not trying to pick on you, but don't even turn around. I'm going to pick a girl back here. But if he would pick this girl because he really likes who she is and what she is and how she thinks and how she behaves and the chemistry is right, in 5 to 8 years, he doesn't have this girl. He has this girl. So what happens is you end up having your kids with somebody who changes in front of you and the chemistry doesn't work anymore. And you cry and wish it did. My wife could holler foul if she wanted to. When we got married, everybody would have said I was happy-go-lucky. Everybody would have said I was social. My standard joke is you've grown up with the reruns. I was Opie Taylor when I grew up. I just happy, red-headed, big ears. That was me. My standard joke is I used to be Opie and now I look like Otis. When did that happen? But the biggest change is not physically. Guys grow old and that sort of thing. But now the biggest thing is when we got married, I was incredibly social. Whatever we could do, let's go places, let's have fun. I could be fun then. I got off work late, but we could still run 100 miles to Tulsa, go eat at that Mexican place. I didn't have to be back to work till 6 the next morning. It's no big deal. Let's go do it. My wife is very social. My wife married me, and we were very much alike, but it didn't take long. I think it had to do with the pain of all the families I worked with. I think it had to do with just my maturity. I liked who I was then, but just maturity. But I became a guy who, if I never went to another party, I'd be happy. My wife is married to a brown paper sack right now. I'm happy and content at who I am. I almost got kicked out of college on a practical joke. I think it was one of the finest practical jokes ever pulled in the history of the college. They called it breaking and entering. It's all perspective, really, on a deal like that. I'm a million miles away from that guy. I like that guy, but that guy's not here anymore. My favorite thing is to go home and read a book. I build custom furniture for a hobby. And my wife and I have a great, great marriage. How? Because my wife married this guy, but she's got this guy. How does my wife still love me when I'm not a because anymore? If you don't know that, then you're marrying almost the equivalent of a snowflake, and you can't hang on to that. It will change and melt and go in different directions. You have to have a comprehension of how to love that transcends. Did you notice both of these are almost alike? I love you if is an internal belief. It's so deep you don't even know you have it. But I'll give you my love if you meet my needs. Nobody can. It's an impossible job. This one is, I'll give you my love as long as you're what I like. But time can't handle that. This is at least 80 to 85% of all American marriages. This is the one you want. This is the one you want. We'll pick it up in the morning. Let me finish on a bit of a more poignant. Russell Dix wrote this. I've used it a lot through the years. Russell Dix, a marriage counselor in Florida, provides a cynical vignette which describes the marriage. Well, here's how it goes. Assuming the feeling of love is irresistible like a flood, many couples invariably find themselves standing before a minister to be married. The minister says, "Do you take this woman with all of her immaturity, self-centeredness, nagging, tears, and high tension to be your wife forever?" The dumb ox, temporarily hypnotized by the prospect of being able to sleep with her every single night, mumbles, "I do." Then the preacher asks the starry-eyed bride, "Do you take this man with all his lust and his moods and his indifference and his immaturity and his lack of discipline? Do you take him to be your husband forever?" She thinks that forever means all of next week, because she's never experienced even 1 month of tediousness or responsibility or denial of her own wishes. And so she chirps, "I do," in the thought that she has now become a woman. Then the patient minister parrots, "By the authority committed to me as a minister of Christ, I pronounce you man and wife." As he does, he prays a silent prayer for forgiveness. For he knows he lies. They are not now husband and wife, and he knows that few of them ever will be. They're now legally permitted to breed, fuss, bully, spend each other's money, and be held responsible for each other's bills. It's now legal to destroy each other, so long as they don't do it with a gun or a club. And the minister goes home wondering, isn't there a more honest way to earn a living? I've been that minister. Before I left this morning, I picked up a 4-year-old little girl who put her arms around my neck and gave me a hug because I'm the preacher at her church. And I'm not making this up. She said, "Will you be my daddy?" My daddy doesn't love us anymore, and my daddy left. Will you be my daddy? What we're doing doesn't work, gang. You better tell these two goodbye. This is the one you want. We're going to pick it up in the morning. God bless.